Well, welcome to Bowden's Coffee House podcast. We're here live at Cafe Culture 2019. And my name is Andrew Bowen. I'm the author of the Daily Grind. Recently wrote the best coffee shop book in the world by bookauthority.com, which I was quite pleased about. Anyway, I'm here, enough of me, so I'm not here about me. I'm here to introduce you to one very, very new good friend of mine, and I'll tell you why that in a second. But let me introduce you to Andrew Brooks, who is the founder of the Keto.
Hello, yes, I'm Andrew, and in 2016, I launched a new style of innovative reusable cup called Poquito, and its principal USP is that it collapses down quite small, and when you pop it up, it pops up to three different sizes.
Interesting enough, I met Andrew here at a coffee culture show, I'll say that anyway, a few years ago when he was first launching it to market. So I've known and watched the progress of the Poquito cup, you know, with great interest over the last couple of years. And it's a really good product. And he's got a fantastic story to tell about how he's done his Kickstarter. My other good friend, my other great friend, and I'll tell you why he's such a great friend, is because it's just gone 12 o'clock and we've had our first shot of whiskey. I'll let Tim Ridley from United Baristas explain, but what was Tim?
Well, actually, this is a bottle of whiskey that came from a friend of mine who works for a distillery in Speyside called Glenfiddich. And they've done an experimental bottling of maturing a whiskey in an IPA cask. So it takes those notes that you would expect from a Speyside whiskey, but just puts a different twist on it because of the finishing. And it's actually the first in the series. So it's actually a reasonably interesting and slightly exclusive bottling. But it's nice to be able to share with other people one of my other passions outside of coffee.
Okay, well, it's very nice to meet you too. So, Tim, you're United Baristas. I know you've done lots of stuff in coffee before that, but now your main day job, for want of a better phrase, is I noticed I saw your name in Caffeine Magazine. You're editor-at-large in Caffeine Magazine as well, I think?
Oh, yeah, I do a number of different things in the coffee industry, but I guess I'm here primarily with my United Baristas hat on. So United Baristas provides some services for the coffee industry, and they're all digital services. So we have a marketplace where baristas can buy and sell used coffee equipment. We have United Baristas Careers, which is essentially a jobs board and a recruitment service for people in the coffee industry. We also launched earlier this year United Baristas Workshop, which connects people who need their espresso machine serviced with engineers and helps them source coffee equipment. And we also have United Baristas Business, which allows coffee business owners to buy and sell their coffee businesses. And I guess the underlying thread to all of these things is that we believe that there are market solutions to a number of the different structural challenges that the coffee industry faces. And so we're building these platforms to be able to better facilitate those markets so that we can help coffee businesses succeed and be viable and endure over the medium term.
You cover an awful lot of bases there. So I've looked at your website before. Actually, I'm a subscriber for a long time. I've subscribed to good stuff. So I keep abreast of what's going on. But it does feel that you're bringing together the coffee industry in lots of different ways, particularly supporting the independent.
Yeah, I think, well, thanks very much for that. I think independent coffee shops have a really special place in my heart because a well-honed, well-run independent coffee shop can actually out-pitch a chain really well because they can offer a product and a service that's more well-suited for that particular neighborhood. And so it just so happens that these are many of the places that I want to drink coffee. And I also drink coffee at, you know, larger coffee businesses as well. You know, I describe myself as a coffee geek, not as a coffee snob. But I think one of the challenges that you face if you're on the small and medium size of business is that you maybe lack the, you're so focused on the data of your business that you maybe lack the industry connections to be able to run some of the facets of your business. And whether that's engineering services or recruiting staff, and that's where we come in. So we support businesses of all sizes, but I guess it's mainly the small and medium businesses at the moment that really find our services the most valuable.
So I know a little bit about Andrew's story, but perhaps it would be nice if you took us through your passion is about environment and about,
It's a long story, really. I was living on the west coast of Canada, Vancouver Island. I used to visit a particular bay every year, do some kayaking and fishing. And one year I came around to the bay as usual, and I saw the mountain, which is usually covered in fir trees, completely shorn of its trees, and I'd never seen anything like it on that sort of scale. I was talking to my Canadian friend about it, and he said, well, yes, that's just a 40-year cull of trees that goes on. Started delving into that story a bit more, and not all those trees, of course, go to make paper cups, but a fair few do. If you know much about the geography of the Pacific Northwest, and being floated down to a very large cafe conglomerate based in Seattle. And that sort of got me thinking about the use of single-use paper products. The more I researched, the more I was convinced that there was a business case. A couple of strands then. Well, firstly, I realized that it was very challenging to recycle paper cups. I'm sure everyone knows that they are lined with plastic. Back in the day when we formed the company in 2014, not that many people actually knew that. There was a lot of dissemination of, shall we say, less than comprehensive information by a lot of companies. There was a bit of greenwashing going on there. Then, of course, I discovered the scale of this, and it's one of those situations, as much as I like data, it's a very hard thing to quantify, but certainly we know in the UK that approximately 3 billion paper cups are disposed of every year. It starts to get a little bit crazy when you talk about the US, because you're somewhere in the 30 to 50 billion range, and even a country such as South Korea uses approximately 20 billion paper cups every year, so the numbers are really quite staggering. So there was that strand, the strand of the damage that was done to the environment by the paper cups. And I suppose finally, in terms of the business case, it was a question of looking at what was available on the market. And there's obviously lots of great reusable cups on the market. I think where our product has the edge is just its supreme portability. We were doing market research and piggybacked on some focus groups that were running in Toronto in Canada. And a lot of people were saying the reason they didn't use their reusable cups was because they tended to be big and bulky and a pain to carry around on public transport. So there you have the strands of the origins of the business. It's recognizing an environmental problem, which is growing, of course, especially with developing markets such as India and China. We also had the notion that these single-use paper cups were not readily recyclable. They are, in theory, but in practice, very, very few are. And finally, there was this question of what was available on the market, and for commuters especially, the larger the cup, the more pain it was to carry around.
So, that's a compelling story. Well, I'd like to talk to you both there about how technology is something, how you funded, how you started in your tech and business. Because lots of people have got great ideas, but actually getting going and getting funded at different stages is a challenge that I know a lot of businesses, particularly independents, suffer with. So, Tim, how did you go about starting, you got to Bristol's all the stuff you've done before?
I guess that's an interesting question. I think we're talking today, I guess, about the environmental impacts within the coffee industry, yeah? And I guess one of the things for me is that the environmental impacts in the coffee industry form part of a larger set of what's sustainability. And to be able to be sustainable, you need to be economically viable. And you need to be also environmentally sustainable, and you need to have some kind of social responsibility. And I think from my experience in the coffee industry, it's become, there's a lot of different pressures across the supply chain at the moment, whether it's economic viability of coffee shops or whether it's the environmental impact that we're having. And being able to find a way is for, the independent sector is so large right now that actually there's over 400 independent coffee shops in London. And so actually we have a cumulative reach of the chains, but because it's fragmented, it's actually very difficult to take collective action. So I think that one of the things that we've really worked to do through United Bristol is be able to provide them with the information and some of the tools to be able that they can actually take action to lower their environmental impacts and to build sustainable and viable businesses so that we can collectively compete with these larger chains, but also create success stories for the proprietors and the people that work within those businesses. So that's really been our focus, to be able to facilitate, if you like, and extend business. So I guess the environmental story is a subset of that. I call myself a closet environmentalist. So, you know, like I don't, when you look at me, like, you know, I'm wearing jeans today and, you know, like I'm not walking around in like a home knitted jumper or something like this. But I've long had an interest in, I guess, lowering my personal impacts on the world and also in the businesses that we have, lowering our impacts as well. And you know, we're in a fortunate enough position that, you know, we have like photovoltaics on the roof and we're able to like heat our own hot water at home, and we have a heat reclamation system at home, and some of these technologies are really interesting. And so over the time that I've been looking at environmental issues, it's been interesting to kind of look at how these apply to the coffee industry. And one of the bits of research that we've been doing over the last 12 months is looking at what the carbon emissions looks like within the coffee industry from crop to cup. And I guess one of the thing that's become really apparent to me is that there's actually a couple of key points where the coffee industry really has quite significant environmental impacts, and they're not necessarily where you might think. So around about, if you were to take like an 8-ounce cappuccino or something like this, around about 70% of the carbon emissions associated with that cup of coffee actually come from the milk, and around about 22% come from the coffee production and the shipping and its roasting and then its making. And maybe we should break down that 22% to some components in a second. And around about 5% come from the takeout cup and the lid. So one of the interesting things, I think, from my perspective, is that everybody agrees. Well, the studies that I've read really agree that the best way to drink coffee is out of a porcelain cup. If you use a porcelain cup more than 300 or 350 times, it's by far and away the best environmentally friendly option. But actually what happens at that point is that the washing of coffee cups is, and in crockery in general actually, uses quite a lot of energy and actually emits quite a lot of carbon. So the incremental gains between reusing something and a single use thing is actually quite small because of the amount of carbon it takes to wash something. So you need to use, say for example, like if you take like a plastic reusable takeout cup, you need to use that probably something in order like 22 times to be able for it to break even. And the more complex reusable cups, you're looking at like dozens or even hundreds, and in some cases the ones with the middle ones, like thousands of reuses. So I guess part of my sort of like starting point for looking at environmental impacts in coffee is that, in compared to some of the other points within the coffee supply chain, the amount of impacts that we have from a carbon perspective is actually quite low through cup selection. And actually the amount of difference that you can create through a behavior change is actually relatively limited compared to some of the other things, like how much hot water we use to be able to create espresso, or how much coffee we throw down the sink, or the amount of energy that we use in air conditioning in shops, or some of these types of things. So we're really trying to provide some of this type of information to refocus and reshape the discussion base so that people can make the decisions that are best for them in terms about how they want to address those environmental impacts. Because obviously the challenge before us is incredibly great, and we will need to do the best things that we can do as we address this challenge.
Yeah, having that information, I think, is absolutely critical. You can't have a great many worrying data-driven decisions unless you've got that clear. It's a very complex area, as you say. There are a lot of vested interests out there that actually aren't happy for people to be aware of those. issues because it puts them in a bad light.
There's also some really good science out there. So if you do a bunch of research, like I guess it's kind of like the gold standard for looking at carbon emissions is a life cycle assessment. And I think it's fair enough to say that I haven't read many life cycle assessments that are that paint a picture of the coffee industry in terms of the independence or the specialty sector that I would typically realise. But you can take the studies that do exist and you can pull out different threads of that. So around about, if you ignore milk, because that's obviously quite a big environmental impact, and there's a wide variety of carbon emissions from the different types of milk. Some more specialist milk producers are far more environmentally friendly than others. But one of the great pressure points is that espresso machines just use an awful lot of power to be able to heat water, and they're really designed for temperature stability, not for efficiency. So we're really encouraging people to look at their espresso machine as the most ineffective way to heat hot water and to just use it for espresso. So not to use the tea spout, to only use the steam ones when for steaming milk and not for other things. And also to be able to look at some changing their behaviours around how much they purge, so that they can still have clean brew pads and delicious cups of coffee, but to basically waste as little hot water as possible. And some of those types of changes that's where the large portion of CO2 emissions that exist within the coffee industry from crop to cup. And that's something that actually we're really well equipped to be able to deal with. And it's exciting to see that some of the espresso machine manufacturers are showing a level of interest in this. And so I think, you know, the next decade in front of us really looks like people employing new technologies within espresso machines to help to essentially make them more energy efficient, in the same way that we've grown accustomed to buying a fridge or a dishwasher with a A or an A+ energy rating. We need to be able to buy espresso machines that are highly energy efficient.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the cost of, I know from my own experience, that the electricity cost of running even a small coffee shop is $10,000. You can't run a coffee shop on less than $10,000 a year of electricity. So we have a larger one, $10,000 or $15,000. It's quite a big cost. I think with any change in even paying and awareness and driving and availability of that change, which is something that you helped with, Andrew, making something available. The biggest challenge for most people with a cup, as you've already said, with a reusable cup, is the fact it's too big to carry. So you know, you've come up with something that definitely encourages people to use a recycled cup, a reusable cup, more than a one single use cup.
Yeah, that's very true. I think the frustration can be that, you know, any reusable cup is only good for the environment or reducing carbon footprint if it's been reused. And I think going back to when I started the business, I looked in the kitchen cupboard, and like a lot of people, I had bought these reusable cups along the journey, you know, take the children to Legoland or whatever it was, and thought, wouldn't that be a good idea, because it would reduce the need to buy soft drinks and what have you. But yeah, the simple fact was I bought them, but I didn't reuse them because they were not that convenient. But going back to what Tim was saying, I think our journey and our environmental stance on this starts right at the origin there with the way that these trees are harvested and the way that they damage the environment very, very early on. You know, Vancouver Island, as those of you who've been lucky enough to go there, is just really I'd love to say a pristine wilderness. It may look that way, but I was there last year, and I think only 6% of Vancouver Island, which is roughly the same size as England, only 6% of that forest hasn't been logged. So since the days of Captain Vancouver, the British Navy in the first instance was keen to cut down the largest trees for their masts, and of course being a typical capitalist, they took the trees that were easiest to cart away, which was the ones right by the water, and that continues to this day. And I think the problem that we have is that people associate paper as being something which is, you know, constantly renewable and has very low value in most people's minds. And I think that's true with paper cups as well. People think about them as being, well, it's just paper, isn't it? But I think when you see the devastation that's left by the logging practices, it looks like something out of a First World War battle scene. And the very fragile soil, for example, is left to the elements. We're talking temperate rainforest here. So you see the way that that topsoil is washed into the salmon spawning streams and that kind of thing. So I think it's one thing to talk about carbon footprint. You know, our cup, for example, pays for itself, as Tim was saying, about you use it 20 times, it covers itself. But I think ours is really I call it a mission, it's not that grand, but the idea is to make people think about something which is very visible in our society. You know, 20 years ago, paper cups weren't really an issue, but these days they're in every movie and every TV show. And they've become a badge, really, of to be cool and to be holding out a particular brand. And I think what we're trying to do is just to, obviously, to make people think about those choices and to offer something that is a convenient alternative, which for commuters especially, that's what our ultra-portable cup does.
Thank you. Now, can I just flip the conversation over to Kickstarter? Because there is a little known fact that Mr. Brooks across the road from me here is in the top 1%, I believe, of all Kickstarters ever with your Paquito cup.
Oh, you big me up, Andrew.
Yeah. You're a massively oversubscribed, I understand. A few years ago, actually, at Cafe Culture, the last one they had at Olympia, I was asked to talk on raising funds for coffee shop expansion. I had a long chat with Andrew, actually, about how he did it. And it's a question that I guess asked a lot from people who want to start up. You know, should I do a Kickstarter? Should I do a crowdfunding thing? And after I spoke to Andrew about it, I realised it's not quite as simple. To be successful, it's not as simple as it looks. So do you want to just take us through some of the sort of key learnings you had from that and how you made it so successful?
Yeah, I think given the time that we've got, it will just have to be some key points, because it really is a very big subject. I think the time that I met Andrew, and I've got to say, by the way, Andrew was my first ever client. I remember writing the order for his Paquito cups, and I was thrilled at that. Within 2 months of meeting Andrew, we started our Kickstarter campaign. It was a way, obviously, to raise funds, but perhaps more importantly, it was a way to launch the product, get it into the public realm, and just make sure we were on the right track, that we had a product that people were going to enjoy and like. Some of the key aspects to Kickstarter would start way before the actual launch date, of course. The biggest initial aspect was to get as much pre-launch publicity as possible. The evening that I met Andrew, I went back to my hotel room in Islington, and I saw an article from a journalist in the Toronto Star, which is Canada's biggest daily newspaper. And I sent her an email and I explained my story. Within a few days of that, she was interviewing me, and that was published in the Daily Star. From that, the BBC radio picked it up, and I was immensely proud to be interviewed by Radio Devon and Simon Bates, who's obviously a hero of mine, within a few days. And from that, we picked up quite a lot of television coverage, and we did very well on the radio and on the major nationals. So it meant the day that we launched, which was the 3rd of November 2016, there was already a groundswell of support, if you like. People had seen that this product was coming out. And it's very important when you're doing a Kickstarter, that kind of crowdfunding campaign, that publicity is front and center. So that would be the first thing, getting a lot of pre-publicity, which of course is added on to your Kickstarter campaign as it evolves. I think the second aspect to that, of course, is just making sure that you've got all your ducks in a row with your marketing. Obviously, you have to come up with a product-based Kickstarter campaign. You have to come up with a product name, for example. And I must have gone through 250 before I selected Poquito. Probably those of you that speak Spanish will know that it comes from the Spanish word for smidgen or small or a touch of. And I spelt it in, I spelt it with a K-I, so P-O-K-I-T-O, because I knew that there were certain countries that would find that easier to pronounce than the Spanish Q-U. So that was part of the journey. And then as the Kickstarter campaign evolved, it's like many things driven by social media interest. And you have to change and adapt your campaign and your publicity as the 30 days of the campaign went on. So that meant contacting the likes of Unilad, which is a university predominantly male-targeted blog that goes out and issuing new videos, etc., to keep the idea fresh in people's mind and keep the impetus going of the campaign. I suppose a third thing too was you have to offer a number of exciting rewards, they call them in the Kickstarter campaign. We started with 2-for-1 deals and reductions if you bought 10, you know, those kinds of things. But as the campaign evolved, we had to be a little bit more creative and think of competitions, for example, different colours that people could vote on to get people engaged. So behind the scenes, there was a whole host of social media, a lot of Facebook activity to get people interested and continually involved over the course of the month-long campaign. And at the end of it, you heave a huge sigh of relief. And as Andrew generously said, we ended up being the top 1% of all-time Kickstarter campaigns. At the time, Kickstarter, since it started in 2009, it had got approximately $28 billion worth of investment money over the 7 or 8 years when we joined it. So to be in the top 1% of all-time campaigns was really a great achievement. And I've got to say, especially because it was a British product and we were pricing everything in pounds, which considering our main customers were US customers, it was really very unusual. So proud of that. But a lot of hard work, Andrew, and a lot of stuff behind the scenes.
Well, as I said, I've had a lot of conversation with on that. I was amazed when you implemented back all of it. So, in summary, it's not a quick way to get money, and you've got to really work out for it to do it. But you have to have a strategy as well, so you just can't just,
Yeah.
Can I just jump in with a question here? Because I've never done a Kickstarter. It's an interesting platform. But I have a number of friends who have been involved in Kickstarter campaigns, and one of the ingredients that they feel is for success is to line up as much funding in advance of launching the campaign as possible, so that you are very quickly at 20, 30, 40, or 50, or even 60%, because people want to back a winner, and then they see it's a winner. Did you line up funding in advance?
I think lining up funding would be a little bit grand. What I was advised was to have a good bank of email subscribers that I could appeal to. I think when I catched everything together, I probably had about 5,000 individuals that I could contact on email. And that was shameless, really. You know, my contacts with my friends probably amounted to about 80 of them. But I went to various different forums to talk about the product. I wasn't selling it at that time, I was just selling the idea. And just to give you one example, I went to the Lib Dem conference in Brighton in September of 2016, and I had a stall there, and I was just telling all the delegates and Vince Cables of this world about the product, and I was able to gather a lot of contact addresses that way. So as the campaign got closer and closer, I would engage those my fan base, if I can call it that, to get them anticipating it. But I think in answer to your, another side of your question there, Tim, was if you're looking to start a Kickstarter campaign and you have nothing in place, and I mean your marketing or your tooling in my case, because obviously we have to produce the cup in an industrial process, all that stuff really has to be part of the game plan, I think. I think I would say with Kickstarter, as much as it was a fantastic experience, it really was the icing on the cake and a marketing exercise to get the word out. By the time you take out your various expenses and the time it takes to get the rewards, etc., you're probably, if you're relying on that to fund everything, you're in for a very difficult journey indeed.
This is an interesting point, isn't it? Because there are a number of different products, coffee-related products, that have been funded on Kickstarter that have been incredibly late to be delivered. I'm waiting on several at the moment. And then there are, in fact, some that I think I'm never going to get. And admittedly, they weren't significant sums of money that I gave these people, but it's still real money that they've taken to pursue maybe what, in retrospect, amounted to be a little bit more than a pipe dream. How do you think, from an outsider's perspective, you can identify the qualities when you're looking at products on these types of crowdfunding platforms that, as you put it, have their ducks lined up and go, well, this is actually something that they're going to be able to deliver on and get my rewards? Because it seems to me that more and more people are interested in this particular point, and that the legitimacy and the credibility of your brand is an incredibly important asset if you're looking to raise money on these platforms.
Yeah, I think in terms of judging that, I think what I did is I looked at the 10 most successful campaigns on crowdfunding websites, mostly Kickstarter, obviously it's still the market leader, and secondly Indiegogo. And I looked at the way they marketed themselves. I looked at the way that the video was filmed and edited, and you know how tight they were. I looked at the final section in Kickstarter, which talks about concerns. I can't remember the exact paragraph about what the header is. But basically, you know, what are you concerned about as a Kickstarter person? And I think in my experience, I wrote there that logistics was something that scared the hell out of me. So to have thousands of individuals interacting with you and wanting their product shipped all over the world was incredibly challenging, and it was also very difficult to meet some expectations. You know, people had the idea that they could pay £4 or £5 for shipping to far-flung places, and that would be tracked shipping. Well, by the time you work out the actual cost of shipping, and that would have been impossible. So people reading the small print. So from my perspective, that was a challenge. But in answer to your fundamental question there, Tim, it would be to look at how they present themselves, and know that some of the most successful Kickstarter campaigns, they do multiple ones, and that would be a good indicator as well that they've got everything lined up.
Somebody in our industry that's done it particularly well is Gary Usher. I don't know if you've heard of him or seen him. He's got a restaurant called Wreckfish, and he's opened about 6 or 7 there. Manchester, mate. And he's got very, very clever. So if anyone's interested in that, definitely look at Gary Usher and see where he does, because he is he's a character as well. I think there was a Channel 4 documentary on him a couple of weeks ago, which was very interesting. So Tim, what's the future? Because we need to wrap up now. Thank you both for coming along and making time. But also, what's the future for United Baristas?
In the best possible way, more of the same. We want to be bigger, reach more people, engage more people. And I think that one of the really great things that I'm getting feedback from about this cafe culture is people are really concerned and interested in the medium-term sustainability of the industry. There's pressures on origin, there's pressures on coffee shops, there's pressures on the way that we drink coffee. And people are really thinking deeply about these issues, and that's incredibly rewarding. And I think for businesses that want to engage in those things, United Bristol is actually providing some real tangible solutions. And at the heart of our marketing strategy is we just want to be useful. If people come to us, use us, like us, we trust that they'll come back and continue to use the platform.
So how do people find you? Your website, I expect you just tap in Google and you have to become us, right?
Oh, absolutely. Thanks very much for giving me the opportunity to get the plug in. It's something I've got to get better at. But yeah, unitedbaristas.com.
That's cool.
And we're on all the normal channels, Instagram, Twitter and the like.
And so Andrew, same question for you. What's the future look like for
Bikito? I think it's fascinating for us. You know, our business has turned around quite dramatically over the last year. We're now able to offer bespoke branding, and we've done some very interesting products for some major companies around the world. But they're trying to offer reusable options for their workers in their factories or in theme parks and that kind of stuff. So we're increasingly doing more branded products. I think really though, for us, we'd like to get the reusable cups into the public mind. We were obviously very fortunate with the likes of David Attenborough talking about the Blue Planet, and there's obviously a lot of controversy about introducing the latte levy and penalising people for using paper cups. That kind of publicity was great in that it got this to the attention of a lot of people who weren't aware of the issue. So I think, along with a lot of other great producers of reusable cups, we're just going to apply our wares, which is a brandable, very portable version of a reusable cup, and hope to scratch away at the public consciousness in that way, and come at it through the independents and the majors and businesses, and theme parks. That's where I'd like to see it evolve over time. So yeah.
So again, if I wanted to buy a Bikito, where would I need to?
Shameless plug alert.
Yeah.
Yes, we're our website, which is fantastic, is Bikito.net, and. Please feel free to go on there for our standard colours, and we also have special colours that we have on there from time to time. We're available in about 500 shops around the UK, including some of the big brands such as Lakeland and Menkind. And of course on Amazon, etc. If I really, really wanted you to buy, I'd be plugging my Bikito.net, because that's cool. Superb.
Okay, well, thank you, guys. Thanks very much. I will imagine the links to all this will be in the show notes. And, yes, thank you once again for coming and meeting us at Cafe Culture.
Thank
and
you.
Enjoy the rest of the show.
Thanks, Andrew.